Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste.
This is the Blackwater Ethercost.
There, I believe that's got it. McThomas, increase the mirror per second. Yes.
Busted thing. Good. Etheric signal is stable. Right then. There are two reasons you are hearing this. One is an ingenious breakthrough I have made in the field of etheric physics. The particular resonance my device produces allows your device to hear my words spoken quietly here in my library, even at extraordinary distance and without any mundane physical connection. My belief is that resonance holds the key to a great many useful effects, although it is tricky. The other reason you are hearing this is that I have selected you for this unique and privileged group. You might share my social standing, or my interest, or both, but one thing you certainly share is my disposition. In the company of the mutually strange, I know I may rely upon your discretion regarding our discussions here, as I am likewise and professionally silent regarding your secrets. Thus the etheric receiver to which you now listen, a gift to you. It is simpler and smaller than the transmitter which I use here, but it is still delicate equipment, so do be careful with it. Nearly a week ago, as I finished calibrating the receivers, my butler informed me that Peter Duncan requested an audience, and that he was more agitated than usual. I suppressed a sigh of resignation, but indicated that Mr. Duncan be shown in. Peter Duncan is, you should know, almost always agitated. He certainly is whenever I see him. Come to think of it, most of my visitors are agitated, though whether it is because of the business which drives them to my doorstep, or because the doorstep is mine, I neither know nor care. Mr. Duncan is a member of the secret occult society in town, formed as such things are by the bored and relatively wealthy. They are harmless enough and amusing, and Duncan is well known to me, so I did not bother even to leave my laboratory to receive him. Besides, he tends to keep his distance more reliably while surrounded by devices which he cannot pretend to understand. He was certainly more agitated than usual, and it took a certain amount of strained patience to draw out the matter which brought him. With many a dinnikin and sorry, he rambled out an unlikely tale. It seems that in performing a new ritual in the cellar of his house, the secret society actually summoned something. Imagine their surprise when their spell worked. A dramatic silence generally follows their incantations, and in that theatrical pause a sound was heard from the cellar's old door which leads to the town's storm drain and sewers. It was a scratching, and clearly the scratching of claws. All heads turned to their leader, William Small, for guidance. He drew himself up, crossed to the door, and slowly opened it. A strange fog spilled into the room, gliding under the haze of incense. "Hallo?" said Small. A moment later, the entire society jumped and cried out in fear, as an unearthly shriek erupted from the darkness, the silvery glowing eyes and teeth of its maker clearly visible at chest level in the tunnel beyond. Mr. Small slammed the door shut and locked it with trembling fingers. And that was the end of their meeting. 4 days had passed since the summoning, during which the occult society attempted to reverse the spell and send the thing back to wherever it came from. They knew it hadn't worked because more and more people reported a strange fog in the woods and very odd sounds, and glimpses of some unknown animal. I had surmised that their unsummoning hadn't worked by the fact that Mr. Duncan was stammering his story to me now. My calibrations being more or less to my satisfaction, I agreed to accompany Mr. Duncan and a few of his society's members to examine his cellar. The solution to their problem could well be scientifically interesting, though I had grave doubts it had anything to do with a chance. The meeting place had all the trappings one would expect of a secret occult society. A shelf of unlikely books, a wardrobe of even more unlikely vestments, utensils and supplies for their rituals. Signs and symbols all over, and an enormous pentagram laid into the floor with what looked like pieces of marble. The atmosphere was full of incense and candles and burned herbs. The secret society members huddled in a knot by the entryway as I investigated. The door Mr. Duncan had mentioned was rough and heavy and old. As I approached it, I understood that at least part of the reason their rituals included so many aromatic components was to counteract the smell of the drain and sewer which lay beyond the door. I should perhaps explain. In order to increase public health and reduce outbreaks of typhoid and diphtheria, some years ago many major cities began to install a far more thorough waste and drainage system than they previously had. A very useful side effect was making the cities smell better. This sounded like a good idea to me. There are some who call me that evil baron, but the fact is, I want my town efficient, well-ordered, and without every street a chamber pot. It is better for the townsfolk as well, and it is hardly my fault that the pre-existing tunnels which make a warren of the region are so convenient to the task. I dare say I deserve applause for making the workers' jobs easier. Holding my breath, I opened the door and peered into the darkness. The fog Duncan had described flowed into the room, a bizarre carpet undulating coolly over my feet to investigate the diagrams on the floor with bluish-silver tendrils. Its color rang a faint bell of memory, but I couldn't place it. The tunnel beyond was empty and silent. I closed the door to consider. A hushed conference between two of our hangers-on caught my attention.
What was that?
Oh, it were nothing at all, my lord.
I really must remember to dial down the scary when it is inconvenient. He eventually reported that an unearthly glowing creature had been seen in the woods north of town. I returned to the castle for hunting clothes, a huntsman, and ghillie. The woods were darkly shadowed in the evening gloom. In an area of steep hills, one can only see so far even at midday, and every branch and rock seemed twisted into bizarre shapes with threatening and impenetrable shadows. We moved quietly, eyes and ears straining for any betrayal of the summoned beast's presence. Twice we heard a croaking yip which none of us had ever heard before, and which seemed to echo from all around us. As we crept carefully from one landmark to the next, the creature suddenly appeared from behind a tree, mere yards from our party. It froze in place, staring at us with uncanny intensity and an obvious piercing hatred. The thing looked somewhat like one of our local red foxes, but very lean, and with legs nearly as long as a deer's. It stood out from the darkened trees with perfect clarity, glowing from its teeth, eyes, and the base of its fur. The glow somehow combined faint silver and a deep, deep blue violet, a dark indigo at the edge of perception, yet driving the eyes to look away as though it were intolerably bright. All this I observed in a moment of crystalline silence. Then the creature gave a long, strangled growl, raised its hackles, and began to stalk toward us. My huntsman smoothly raised his rifle into place, but before he could pull the trigger, the thing sensed his intent and darted away into the next ravine. As we crested the ridge between ravines, I saw one of my footmen approaching from the direction of town, a darkly dressed man in tow. We paused and made introductions, and inquired what was so urgent it couldn't wait until he returned. The man was André Dupont, a high-ranking member of an organization which supplied factories around Calais with hard-to-find equipment, or with easier-to-find assets, at a much better price than legality allowed. Normally, his cartel kept its territory with an iron fist and little trouble, but a rival mob threatened their business, promising to bring it to a violent halt and showing signs of possible success in their attempt. Mr. Dupont had been sent to commission a weapon of technological terror which would defend the cartel's compound in such a way that no enemy would again dare to challenge them. Dupont seemed more the sort to hunt creatures in a city than in the Highland wilds. However, out of a misplaced sense of politeness and my gracious nature, I invited him to accompany our party so long as he could keep quiet when it was needful. He agreed, though he peppered our travels with ideas he had for what sort of weapon I could create. He was an earnest fellow and somewhat annoying. the two come together distressingly often. Ah, yes, they've arrived. It occurred to me that an excellent demonstration of etheric transmission would be a musical performance. You will find it far more pleasing and lifelike than any gramophone's wax cylinder. No warping of tones, no muffled sound, simply remarkable. Last night, our entertainment was a group of traveling musicians called the Poxy Boggards, a strange name for some strange if high-spirited men. How accurately they have named themselves, and whether they travel by choice or to flee pursuit, I am uncertain. The one surety is that after last night, I need to procure more ale. Regardless, they make very fine music. I have asked them to give us an additional song, for your benefit.
Good sailors sing songs of lassies and bravery and fortune. How the sea fills their hearts with the courage to do mighty deeds. But I'll sing a song of a lad that I met in Jamaica, who tested the bravest of brave in all seven seas. It were
Happy Jack's undrinkable ale. One mighty sup would so win me your sail. It's Happy Jack's undrinkable ale.
Captain would try the tankard of Jack's mighty potion. He seemed all right, so we all went off to bed. Woo! To the screams of our captain way up in the crow's nest. He tried to fly with the wind, but he ended up dead.
It were Happy Jack's undrinkable ale. One mighty sup would slow wind in your sail. It's Happy Jack's undrinkable ale.
This ale was as black as a night with the moon in December, as bitter as a man who lost his pistol in May, as strong as sick horses, as evil and wicked as Judas. Of Jack the worldliest drinkers most surely say,
it were Happy Jack's undrinkable ale. One mighty sup puts the wind in your sail. It's Happy Jack's undrinkable ale.
I sailed with a lad who was tall and as white as a mountain. One half a pint put this sailor down upon one knee, and we watched as he turned as white as the high cliffs of Dover, then threw up old Jack's as a gift to the mighty blue sea.
It were Happy Jack's undrinkable ale. One mighty sup put so wind in your sail. It's Happy Jack's undrinkable ale.
I once tried a thimble of Jack's demonic invention, but for the spinning I felt that I was all right. I woke with a chicken, two ducks, a lamb and an oxen. By the looks on their faces I must have had a good night.
Smells like Happy Jack's undrinkable ale. One mighty sup would so wind in your sail. It's Happy Jack's undrinkable ale. Happy Jack's undrinkable ale. One mighty sup puts the wind in your sail. It's Happy Jack's undrinkable ale.
The ravine we entered was littered with patches and tendrils of the silvery fog we had seen in the tunnel. In fact, it was the very ravine into which the drain eventually led. As we neared the tunnel mouth, the fog thickened on the ground and prevented any hope of tracking the creature. Instead, we turned our search toward the source of the fog, somewhere in the tunnel. Perhaps our quarry would be found there. Inside the foul passage, the silvery vapor played with our lanterns, casting shadows where nothing solid existed to cast them. At this point, the tunnel was rough and unfinished, an ancient mine broken with rock long fallen from the walls and ceiling. The murk crept in and out of side passages, seeming to come to and from everywhere. We chose a tunnel branch at random, and followed it until it began to slope upward. No fog came from above, so that clearly wasn't the source. We returned to the main tunnel and chose another. The next branch of the mine led around several corners and ended in a shaft downward, the fog slowly flowing into the hole and down into nothingness. It was disturbing, but it was not the source. We had to try again. On the way back to the central tunnel, The light of my lantern caught a piece of parchment snagged in a crevice of the wall. I pulled it out and examined it carefully. One side was a map of the region, faded and none too accurate. The other side held part of her hastily written message. The first part had been torn away when it caught in the tunnel wall, but there was almost enough remaining to make some sort of sense of it. It is a tale of fear and madness. I shall relate to you the contents of the parchment, but not in its original form. You see, even the modern manner of speech employed by the locals is not easily understood by anyone from even 60 or 70 miles away. Some of you reside a great deal farther, and the parchment was written many years ago, so it would be, without exaggeration, completely incomprehensible. I shall render it into something more reasonable to call English. With that caveat, this is what it said. Strode toward me until its face was mere inches from mine, pale, pale, like snow in a shadow. You have broken the contract, yes, and knew it. Did you think to escape without consequence? The palace wavered behind it as though I had drunk too much, and shed white leaves that fell among the court. I heard the creaking again, as of some huge door, and the yellow-red thing held me tighter. Put him in, it said, and turned to go back to the dais. The creature that held me pulled me to where the awful opening had reappeared, and my struggles meant nothing to it. Then I suddenly sneezed, and for no reason I understand, it let go and jumped back. I did not question my luck. Hoping that it was still open in its way, I sprinted to the shimmering arch, expecting every step to feel the furred claw again, and dove through. I was not where I had entered, though not far either. The old mine was nearby, safe from the frozen rain and the things that hunted me through it. I chose a tunnel, this one, to put more distance between myself and my pursuers, and followed to where it ended in a shaft, where a small fire would attract no notice from the outside world. It was not until too late that I wondered why a shaft from below would have good air coming from it. The first bit of sound reminded me, though. The yellow-red beasts natively lived underground, and right now would be near the surface, as I was. I have written what I have time for. You must be careful with what you bargain in these woods. Everything I could find has been piled onto the shaft opening, and the beasts are pulling at my barricade from below. Soon I shall have to face them behind me, or the hunters ahead in the woods. I shall take my chance with the hunters. They come. That was the end of it. Years ago, madness or sickness had overcome some poor soul, and every branch and rock became monstrous in his eyes. I know these woods, these hills, better than most know their own home. The weather and the cliffs are more dangerous than any creature in it, save myself. But someone lost, with a bad map, and hungry, could easily eat something that would make an end of him. Thus the dangers of wandering alone and unknowing. We returned to our search. It was some time before another tunnel or fork occurred, and we slowly moved up the primary tunnel. More than 100 yards of winding, uneven travel later, we came upon a glowing pool, an eddy at the side of the repulsive stream, a silvery cauldron slowly turning and bubbling, the strange fog continuously flowing from it. And all around it were huge tracks, as though made by some enormous fox. It didn't take me long to realize that the strange pool was made from a chemical experiment I had performed some weeks before. The sight of the swirling liquid sparked my memory, and I recalled the color from the failed experiment. It must have combined with the unknowable chemistry of the sewer and storm drain to produce this. I also remembered that I had ordered the remaining chemicals properly disposed of, and it would seem that they had not been. I sent the footman with a message to McThomas to have the culprits who dumped it into the laboratory come clean the mess here. Mr. DuPont was sent with him. I agreed to produce a weapon for his cartel and would draft an initial contract upon my return to the castle. In the meantime, he would be shown every courtesy and, moreover, would be out of my way. That done, we returned to the woods to continue our hunt. 2 days later, today in fact, I summoned Peter Duncan to tell him that his accidental summoning had been taken care of. What was it? How had I managed to banish it? Was it likely to return? I assured the ever-anxious Mr. Duncan that they would be hard-pressed to summon any such creature again, even if they specifically attempted to. Oh, the "thank you, my lord, thank yous" that followed. He's not a bad sort, you know, just... He was so excited when he left to tell his secret society the good news, he somehow neglected to observe, directly above the door he used, my new hunting trophy. Perhaps it was the afternoon light which made it hard to notice the uncanny glow, silver and indigo at the edge of sight, which came from the teeth and fur of the mounted head of an enormous fox.
The Blackwater Aethercast is written, produced, and performed by Nicholas Jovian. Additional voices by Kayla Thomas. Beginning and ending music is by Derek and Brandon Fichter. They can be found at dbfichter.bandcamp.com. Today's entertainment was the Poxy Boggarts. Get their music at poxyboggarts.com. Be sure to subscribe to the Aethercast and send your friends to lordblackwater.com so they can too. A new chapter is released every 2 weeks. Also, visit lordblackwater.com to be the featured entertainment. Thanks for listening. We appreciate you.